This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you listening. The producers for this program, Jack Brighton, Harriet Williamson. On the board this morning, Brian Wagner. And just a quick mention that tomorrow morning on the program, in the first hour of our show, we'll be speaking with Millard Fuller. He's founder and president of Habitat for Humanity International. He'll be joining us by telephone. And then here in the studio, we'll have Jeff Ford. He's executive director of Habitat for Humanity in Champaign County. And we'll be talking about this organization, what they do both internationally and regionally. Then in the second part of the show, we'll talk about some issues in women's health. And there our guest will be Judy Norsegian, senior program officer with the Boston Women's Health Book Collective, the folks who produced that now famous volume, Our Bodies, Ourselves. That'll be tomorrow morning, the second part of the show. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you each week. We always give you the opportunity to call in when you have questions and comments. You may also find us on the web. We're broadcasting, webcasting, 24 hours a day. So if you like, you can listen through your computer. Also, we have archives there of interviews from past Focus programs, also Afternoon Magazine, Commodity Week, Sidetrack, news features, all sorts of stuff there that you can listen to anytime you like. It's all at will.uiuc.edu. Just go there, click on listen, and if you have not done this before, there is free software available there. You've got to look closely to get it, but it's there. You don't have to pay money for it if you're interested in listening through your computer. So again, will.uiuc.edu. That's the address, and you can check it out. This morning in the second hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about aquaculture, or perhaps in more plain speech, we're talking about fish farming. When in the last few years, a number of years, the seafood industry around the world has been going through a major transition, moving away from mostly fish that have been caught in the wild, so to speak, and moving towards fish farming as a source of seafood. And we'll be talking this morning sort of about this and its environmental implications with our guest, Dr. Rebecca Goldberg. She is a biologist in the New York Office of the Environmental Defense Fund and, in fact, is director of EDF's biotechnology program. She's written about this and other subjects and for the fund. Her academic training is at University of Minnesota. She has a master's degree in statistics and PhD in ecology and behavioral biology from Minnesota. She joined the staff of the Environmental Defense Fund in 1987, and she's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk with Dr. Goldberg, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also do have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere that signal will travel. You may use the toll-free line and the calls on us. That's 800-222-9455. Again, and if you match the numbers and the letters on the phone, you get WILL. So this may or may not make it easier, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Dr. Goldberg, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me to be on your show.
Well, I think it's an interesting area. Of course, here there is a lot of farming that's going on, but it's a different kind of farming. So for us, this is an unusual topic, but it does indeed touch us because of this dramatic expansion, I think, in people's interest in having seafood in the diet. We're advised that it's good for us. So certainly it's the kind of thing that touches us as consumers, if not on the production end of things.
Mm-hmm. Although, isn't there increasing interest in the Midwest in some ex-hog farmers producing fish in tanks in the
ponds? Well, that may well be, and I guess that's an important point to make at some point here, that when you think about doing aquaculture, there are a couple of ways to do it. There are places all along the coast of this country, and I'm sure a lot of other places, where what they do is essentially they construct pens in the water, and they raise the fish in them. But you don't have to be near the ocean to do aquaculture. You could do it anywhere simply by building, as you say, big tanks to raise the fish in.
Absolutely. And in particular, the predominant form of aquaculture in the U.S. is actually freshwater aquaculture, not marine aquaculture. That's true worldwide, actually, as well as in the U.S. So lots and lots of aquaculture is inland.
Yeah. Just maybe we can talk a little bit about this change that I just mentioned very briefly, and that is the fact that as fish stocks, wild fish stocks around the world have increasingly become depleted and demand has gone up, in an effort to satisfy that demand, the industry has turned more and more to raising the fish. Can you put some numbers on that?
Well, aquaculture now supplies close to a third of all fish consumed by humans worldwide. In the U.S., it's a very important source of seafood. If you look at the top five seafoods consumed in the U.S., excluding canned tuna, three of them, shrimp, salmon, and catfish, come either heavily from aquaculture in the case of shrimp and salmon, or entirely from aquaculture in the case of catfish. So aquaculture is an important source of seafood. Worldwide, aquaculture production more than doubled in both value and by weight of production between 1987 and 97. Clearly it's growing gangbusters. Here in the U.S., the growth rate has been considerably slower than worldwide, but there still has been steady growth in the industry. Some people in agriculture or in aquaculture term it the fastest growing sector of U.S. agriculture, although I suppose it depends on what you call a sector of U.S. agriculture. But there's no doubt but that it's a growing form of production. I think what it's important to realize, though, is that aquaculture isn't just one activity. It's really the production of a wide range of species in a wide range of systems. And some people, when they speak of aquaculture, include not only farmed fish and shellfish, but also farmed seaweed, which is important in Asia, much less so in the United States. So aquaculture facilities can vary from what are termed net pens, exactly what they sound like, big nets put in coastal waters to raise fish like salmon, to tanks in somebody's barn, or the ponds in the southeast United States for catfish, or prepared oyster beds in the Gulf of Mexico or Long Island Sound off Connecticut, and so on. So it's really a very diverse group of activities that together make aquaculture.
There are certainly environmental impacts of both of these. And maybe we could talk about some of these things. I guess initially one of the first things that comes to mind is that you're raising animals and animals produce waste.
Absolutely.
So one way or another, that's something that you've got to deal with, and it doesn't matter. Maybe the issues are somewhat different if you're raising them in tanks. That's one thing you have to deal with that. And then there, I'm sure, are implications for the fact that you are raising them in the open ocean and that then that waste ends up going into the ocean ecosystem.
Absolutely. Well, certainly people in the Midwest are quite familiar with issues surrounding animal waste, particularly from large hog facilities. And aquaculture certainly isn't occurring at the same scale in this country at the moment as swine production. But fish do produce waste, and when they're fed, food is put in the water, and some of it doesn't get eaten, and so on. So waste from fish can be significant pollutants, at least locally. Clearly, some sorts of aquaculture systems are much more amenable to pollution control than others. Tank-based systems, have a clear wastewater discharge pipe, and it's, relatively easy if farmers want to or are required to remove the nutrients and organic matter and so on from fish waste. Some of the most troublesome facilities are net pens that are used to grow salmon, which basically use the water around them as the dumping ground. And when net pens are used on a small scale, just like when animals are put in a pasture, there's probably not a big effect. I mean, to put it crudely, fish poop in the ocean anyway. But obviously, as farms get large, the effects of waste can become significant. To give an example, in the U.S. and Canada, there's significant salmon production on the Maine New Brunswick border on the East Coast. And on the New Brunswick side of the border, a colleague of mine at the Conservation Council of New Brunswick, who's a marine scientist, did a calculation of the human sewage equivalent of nutrients from a farmed salmon in New Brunswick. And she found that farmed salmon in New Brunswick produced the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus equivalent to the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus in untreated human sewage from a city of about 100,000 to 200,000 people. In contrast, the number of people who live in Charlotte County in New Brunswick, where all the salmon farms are, is about 30,000. So clearly salmon farms are locally the largest source of nutrients. So the effects of aquaculture can be quite significant on a local scale, and it's certainly issues of waste are something that some people in the industry are now addressing, but a lot more needs to be done.
Yeah, I'd say I have been to that area and I have seen them. And as you say, the fish pens are very close offshore. They want them to be relatively easy for the fishermen. And they have to get there to be able to feed the fish and to be able to harvest the fish. So you don't want them relatively close.
Well, but also shelter from storms, actually.
Yes. But also here we are talking about there has been a lot of concern about water quality in coastal areas because of concentrations of human populations and what that does to the water there. But here now we're introducing yet another sort of source of waste that might people might think about it a little bit differently because, as you say, well, let's say it's a bunch of fish, and we already have a bunch of fish in the sea anyway, so does it really make very much difference that we're concentrating a large number of fish in this relatively small place?
No, you could make the same argument for animals on land. We already have animals on land, and obviously, you know, at some level, you know, having some animals in your pasture doesn't matter, but when you have a confined facility with, you know, thousands or tens of thousands of animals, it does begin to matter.
Mm-hmm. Well, don't the regulatory bodies, those that are concerned about environmental quality, both the United States and Canada, pay some attention to the impact that aquaculture can have on the water quality in coastal waters?
Well, I'd have to say it's somewhat uneven. Here in the United States, there are actually no national standards under the Clean Water Act for fish farms. EPA is in the early stages of developing such standards now at the urging of my organization and some other organizations in the environmental community. But oddly enough, many of the fish farms in the state of Maine, the salmon production facilities along the coast, currently have no wastewater discharge permits. And that's because basically of EPA's failure to develop any standards for such farms.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're speaking with Dr. Rebecca Goldberg. She is a biologist. She works for the Environmental Defense Fund. She's director of EDF's biotechnology program. And we're talking here about aquaculture and the environmental impacts of aquaculture. As we've mentioned, it is the international seafood industry within the last perhaps decade or so has been going through a major change as the natural stocks of fish have become depleted and demand has gone up. There has been a great increase in fish farming. And in fact, now just about all of the catfish and trout, a lot of the shrimp, a goodly amount of the salmon that people eat here in the United States, all of this is raised by fish farming. Questions are certainly welcome, and we have someone we'll get right to. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, also toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take this caller here in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I feel I'm an average consumer, and I want to increase my use of fish in my diet. I want to avoid mercury, and I wish to be friendly to the environment. And I wonder if you have any tips for the average consumer, what kinds of fish we should be consuming and what we might be avoiding.
Okay. I'd be more than happy to address that question. In response to interest from consumers, several organizations, including my own, now have information available on good choices and not-so-good choices to make when purchasing seafood, mainly in the context of the environmental or ecological effects mm-hmm. of catching or farming fish. Our website, www.environmentaldefense.org, has lists of some of the best fish to choose and fish that are best to avoid on environmental grounds. The National Audubon Society has a really spectacular book out now. It's available through Amazon.com and probably other stores. It's called The Seafood Lover's Almanac, and I highly recommend it. The Monterey Bay Aquarium on its website also has a lot of information about choices consumers can make, again, in the context of environmental protection.
Can you give me perhaps a list of fish that I can eat that don't do any harm to the environment and also don't give me mercury?
Okay. Well, let me go on and talk a little bit about the issues of toxins in fish, and then I can get back to a list. There is remarkably little data on the levels of toxins in fish that are traded commercially. Many states and the Environmental Protection Agency have information for recreational fishermen, fishing various types of fish out of streams and lakes and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But for marine fish coming from the ocean, where FDA is responsible, the absence of data is just stunning. It's just alarming. That said, an organization called the Environmental Working Group recently published a study called Brain Food, What Women Should Know About Mercury in Fish, that gave some advice to consumers. And basically, the study argues that women who are pregnant or might be becoming women or perhaps children, and that's the population most vulnerable to mercury, should avoid tuna in the form of steaks, sea bass, oysters from the Gulf of Mexico, marlin, halibut, pike, walleye, white croaker, and largemouth bass.
My goodness.
And then the report goes on to list some fish that maybe you shouldn't eat more than once a month if you're, at least if you're a woman of childbearing age or perhaps a child, and that includes canned tuna, mahi-mahi, blue mussels, eastern oysters, cod, pollock, Great Lakes salmon, blue crab from the Gulf of Mexico, wild catfish, and lake whitefish. You might notice that of these species, most of the fish that are traded commercially in this country are marine fish, but in these lists, disproportionately appear freshwater fish. The source of the fish, and also where it is on the food chain, fish that are top predators tend to have the most opportunity to accumulate mercury and other sorts of toxins. Those are at least two things that can help guide choices of fish. Now, in terms of fish. So
all the things that you labeled as potentially mercury hazards seems to be everything I would eat except perhaps scallops.
Right, although some of this, it depends on the source. For example, oysters from the Gulf of Mexico are listed, but not oysters from the Northeast or Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm. But yes, there are a number of fish that are apparently high in toxins. One good choice, though, to make is salmon from Alaska, both because the evidence that exists suggests it's relatively low in toxins, although I'm not sure that there's extensive data available, and certainly on ecological grounds, the wild salmon fishery in Alaska is well managed and the salmon are abundant. So they're a good choice. In contrast, there are a number of ecological concerns about farm salmon, and also potentially some food safety concerns. At least in Europe, there are no data available from North America to speak of yet, but in Europe, there's been now some examination of dioxin levels in this feed of farm salmon. Salmon are carnivores. They tend to eat feeds that are high in fish meal and fish oil that are essentially made from ground-up small fish, and the feeds seem to be relatively high in dioxin. Again, there's not a lot of data looking at the levels of dioxin in farm salmon that's actually in grocery store shelves, particularly, I don't know of any in the United States, but one really good choice to make is wild salmon from Alaska. Some other choices that you could consider tend to be better choices might include Alaskan pollock, which is often available in the form of fish sticks, New Zealand hoki, which is also a fish stick sort of fish.
Could you spell both of those for me, please, the Alaskan and the New Zealand?
Hoki, H-O-K-I. Doesn't mean that there are no issues around these fisheries at all, but compared to others, they tend to be a reasonable choice. The farm catfish are a reasonable choice, also inexpensive. Farmed shellfish, such as mussels and oysters, a reasonable choice if they come from clean water. Although the way it's raised is fairly variable, farmed tilapia is probably a reasonable choice to make.
Tilapia.
Tilapia.
How do you spell it?
T-I-L-A-P-I-A. Now, as I give you this information, I want to acknowledge that, you know, there is variation in how any particular type of fish is caught from location to location or how it's farmed. So I'm broadly categorizing these fish. But
right.
those are some types of fish that, I buy to feed my family.
And you mentioned Alaskan pollard. Is that
pollock? P-O-L-L-O-C-K.
P-O-L-L-O-C-K, okay.
Yes. There are some issues with pollock. Environmentally, in that at least a little bit of the nearshore fishery seems to take pollock that are also important in the diets of Stellar sea lions, which are endangered species, and there's controversy about that aspect of the pollock fishery. On the other hand, pollock are relatively abundant through most of their range. Anyway, that's it.
Well, I thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
And do look at the websites and for information.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's go on to another caller here. That will be on our line number two, and that's in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning. I hope this isn't a repetition and part of what the first caller had mentioned, but I understand from some people, and I hope you can clarify this, that as with farm-raised, livestock, with the fish populations, a lot of antibiotics, et cetera, are used especially in shrimp farming. Is that the case with shrimp, and is it the case with other animals that are farm-fed? And also a question on the substance. You did touch on that with regard to the food that's given to farm animals, ground-up fish and so forth. Could you please comment on the possible sources of, pollution, things that a lot of people that are into the organic movement are very much concerned about? Thank you.
Okay. Those are good questions. To start with the antibiotic issue, there are real concerns about antibiotic use in fish farming. There is no strong evidence that there is heavy antibiotic use in U.S. fish farming, although there isn't much or really any data, I should say, well, not much data available on how much antibiotics are actually used. But unlike production of pigs and chickens and cows in this country where antibiotics are routinely fed to these animals, as growth promoters. I mean, they're fed to healthy animals on a daily basis. That sort of use of antibiotic is illegal in this country for fish production. So compared to the way much of the meat is produced in this country, particularly chickens and pigs in factory farms, fish is actually a better choice in terms of antibiotics if it comes from the U.S. On the other hand, practices abroad may not be so great. I have been told anecdotally by someone who worked in Chile that Chilean salmon farming and most of our farmed salmon in this country comes from Chile, or at least that Chile is the biggest source of imported farm salmon to this country. Anyway, Chile has a heavy use of antibiotics in salmon production. There's certainly historically been a lot of antibiotic use in shrimp farming in Asia. So certainly antibiotic use in aquaculture is an issue primarily abroad. A lot of our seafood does come from abroad, particularly all of the farm shrimp we would get, most of the farm salmon. So antibiotic use can be an issue. Particularly troubling to me at the moment is that the Food and Drug Administration is at the moment not sampling for antibiotic residues in any imported farmed fish. So although Food and Drug Administration surveillance of antibiotic residues in farmed fish has always been pretty scant, at the moment it's non-existent. On to your second question about the use of fish to feed fish, this is a huge issue for aquaculture. One of the ironies of aquaculture is that it's often promoted as a means to supplement world fish supplies, and some people will go so far as to argue that aquaculture may actually even take some of the pressure off of marine fisheries by providing an alternative source. In fact, many forms of aquaculture, particularly aquaculture that's used to produce fish for people in industrialized countries like the U.S., focuses on the production of fish that are carnivores in the wild, like salmon, or that are typically, when they're farmed, given diets that are essentially carnivorous, like the diets of farmed shrimp. And the diets of these fish are high in fish meal and fish oil that are made from small wild-caught fish that, for the most part, are caught expressly for the purpose of making fish meal and fish oil for animal feeds. So for many types of farmed fish, it actually takes more fish caught from the ocean to produce a pound of farmed fish than you get out at the end, if that makes sense. For example, it takes 2 to 3 pounds of wild-caught fish in the form of fish meal to produce a pound of farmed salmon. So while that may make economic sense in that small, not very valuable wild fish are caught to raise much more economically valuable farmed fish, ecologically, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And certainly to the degree that people are interested in using aquaculture to supplement marine resources, we shouldn't be farming the types of fish that actually require huge inputs of marine resources.
Oh, very good. I had one further question, if there's a moment to add. And specifically, you were listing types of fish that were relatively safe, and I'll use that term generic. Does orange roughy from Australia fall into the category of a farm fish or an ocean fish? And
orange roughy is entirely wild caught. I would not recommend eating orange roughy based on ecological grounds. Orange roughy are a deep ocean fish, live in very cold water. They grow very slowly. An orange roughy you buy in the supermarket may be as old as your grandmother. and they have been overexploited. Orange roughy became popular, a decade or so ago. There became a huge fishery for them. And these fish just can't reproduce at a rate to sustain more than a low-level catch. I don't know specifically about the management of the orange roughy fishery in Australia versus in other countries, but as a rule of thumb, I don't buy them.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. We are a little bit past the midpoint here. Again, our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Rebecca Goldberg. She is a biologist with the Environmental Defense Fund. We're talking about some of the environmental impact of fish farming, aquaculture. Now, more and more of the fish that we have available to us in supermarkets and fish markets here in this country and other places as well is farm-raised. And we're talking about some of the implications of this trend. Your questions are welcome. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. I'm also looking here at one of these lists of fish, good choices, ones that you suggest to avoid on the EDF website. And this, I think, is just based on issues of, say, environmental impact, sustainability, and there are a number of fish here that on this list that I know are available here in Champaign-Urbana, mm-hmm. and I'm thinking about why it is that some are good and some are bad, and for example on the list of ones that are good to choose, one of the fish is tilapia, and on the ones to avoid, you're suggesting people avoid farmed salmon, and I know personally I like salmon a lot, and a lot of the salmon we get here, I'm sure is farmed. Is that pretty much the issue, the one thing that we were just talking about, and the fact that tilapia is, they're herbivores and salmon are carnivores, and that's the difference in how they're produced?
Well, that is certainly one factor, although tilapia will eat a diet that's relatively high in fish meal, and actually the diets of commercially produced tilapia are somewhat variable. But there are other concerns about salmon production in addition. One of them we talked about earlier, salmon are produced in what are termed net pens in coastal bays and estuaries that basically have no pollution control of any sort. The coastal waters just go through the salmon net pens, sweeping out the waste. Besides the water pollution from salmon farms being an issue, there's perhaps an even bigger issue with what's termed biological pollution from salmon farms. Net pens in coastal waters are very prone to breakage, to tears in storms or because of human error or because seals try and get at the salmon in the pens. And there are often large-scale escapes of farmed salmon. That's become a big issue both on the east and the west coast of this country and of Canada. Virtually all the salmon that are farmed are Atlantic salmon, which are native to the Atlantic Ocean. Yet so many salmon have now escaped from Washington State and British Columbia salmon farms that there are now Atlantic salmon reproducing on Vancouver Island in British Columbia, and there's considerable concern about what that means for the competition of Atlantic salmon with the native Pacific salmon species, some of which in the lower down in the Pacific Northwest than Alaska, further south than Alaska, some of these fisheries are in trouble. So that's of great concern. On the East Coast, there are now so few wild Atlantic salmon left in Maine that last November the federal government listed the remaining runs of wild Atlantic salmon under the Endangered Species Act as endangered species. And one of the major impediments that has been identified by the National Marine Fisheries Service to the restoration of wild Atlantic salmon populations are the escaped farmed salmon, which in many cases outnumber the wild salmon, will interbreed with the wild Atlantic salmon, and as a result end up filling the wild with hybrids between cultivated and wild salmon, which are genetically less fit or genetically less well adapted to Maine rivers than the wild salmon.
So in both cases, you're looking at the kind of problems that come along with an introduced species.
Absolutely. And issues to do with introduced species, occur for all sorts of farm fish, but for salmon, the issues have been particularly acute, in large part because there are such large-scale escapes of salmon from salmon net pens. For example, there was escape of salmon from net pens in Maine last winter of about 100,000 fish. Norway, which has the world's largest salmon farming industry, through the mid-1990s was losing about 1 million fish a year from salmon net pens. So we're not just talking about the occasional escape of a fish or two, but really some very large-scale events.
Let's go on. We'll get back to the phones here with someone calling from the western suburbs of Chicago here. This is line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm glad to hear this. I'd like to ask, what about dory fish, D-O-R-Y, grenadier, canned salmon, canned sardines?
I don't know what a grenadier is. I have a limited understanding of Oreo dory, but I believe that it's also a cold water fish from sub-Antarctic waters, sort of like orange roughy.
So is cold water not good?
Well, no, it means the fish can grow very slowly, and I believe that there are some problems with overfishing of Oreo dory, but again, it's not something I'm terrifically knowledgeable about. Mm. And then you asked about canned sardines.
Sardines.
Yeah.
And fresh sardines.
Right. On the whole, I think that sardines ecologically are a good choice. Sardine populations certainly rebound very quickly. They're not particularly long-lived fish. Mm-hmm. Ecologically, I think they're fine. I have never seen any data on toxins in sardines. I would assume since they're relatively low on the food chain in the ocean, that they tend to be somewhat lower in toxins. But again, you know, it's back to the fact that we don't know about a lot of what may or may not be in various types of fish from around the world.
But you said canned tuna has a lot of mercury in it.
Well, canned tuna has some. Actually, fresh tuna is often regarded as a higher, a bigger source of mercury. And I'm here reporting on the results of a report by an organization called the Environmental Working Group. My understanding is that the tuna canning industry makes some effort to limit the levels of mercury in canned tuna. Nevertheless, tuna is a top of the food chain fish and more prone to having mercury in it than fish that are lower on the food chain.
Mm-hmm.
As you go up the food chain, you know, big fish eat, littler fish eat, well, I should just take a look down the food chain, you know, there are fewer steps between what was eaten and plants that are at the bottom of the food chain or algae, and there's less opportunity for a low food chain fish to what's called bioaccumulate toxins than there is for a top of the food chain fish.
Mm-hmm. And cod? Codfish?
Cod. Atlantic cod remain in deep trouble ecologically. They've been severely overfished in the past. There is now an effort to rebuild the cod stock. But it's not there. Cod have not yet really rebounded yet. Moreover, another issue, something we haven't talked about, is how fish are caught. As we think about the ecological consequences of fishing, certainly one thing to be concerned about is how well is the stock managed? Is it fished at levels that make the stock sustainable, or is it overfished so that the stock declines and eventually, as in the case of the cod, even collapses? A separate issue is that some of the fishing gear that is used to catch fish actually is ecologically destructive on its own. And cod, like a number of other types of fish, is caught with trawls that scrape along the bottom of the ocean and not only catch cod, but other fish that are in their path. Plus, as the gear scrapes along the bottom of the ocean, it stirs up basically the sand or whatever substrate is at the bottom of the ocean, killing the critters that are in that, and can actually physically, over years, and areas will be trawled over and over and over, literally change the appearance of the bottom of the ocean and the structures at the bottom of the ocean. So trawling gear is widely regarded as ecologically destructive. And cod are, for the most part, caught with trawling gear. There is one neat group of fishermen on Cape Cod called the Cape Cod Commercial Hook Fishermen's Association, which is now catching cod with hooks and lines. They found that actually by avoiding trawls, by catching cod with hooks and lines, they can bring in fish that don't get battered as they do in trawl nets. They can even bring in live fish, and they can fetch a higher price for cod in the market. And they're doing something terrific. You can buy their fish if you're in New England, but I doubt it in Champaign-Urbana.
Mm-hmm.
The point I want to reinforce is that there are a number of factors that go into the ecological effects of fishing, mm-hmm. and in some cases the gear is terribly destructive. I would argue that we tolerate destruction in fishing that would be unthinkable in land. I have a colleague at another environmental organization who compares trawling to not just cutting down trees, but scooping up a lot of the soil around the trees, too, when you log. We wouldn't tolerate that on land, but we tolerate it under the sea where people never see what goes on.
So I wasn't quite, you said wild salmon. Well, how do we know this? The clerk behind the counter doesn't know anything.
Right. Well, certainly when you go into a restaurant, all you can do is ask, and the cook may or may not have the information. Many supermarkets, though, do post information about the source of the fish that they have at the seafood counter. And if it's not posted, ask.
So, I do. And what would you suggest are the best things to shop for?
As I said earlier, there are some...
I did hear earlier.
Okay.
I'm a little confused about the shrimp and shelled fish and the salmon. I know you said wild
salmon. Wild salmon from Alaska are a terrific choice.
Tilapia, yeah.
Tilapia is a reasonable choice. The production facilities vary, but it's certainly a fish I buy for my children. Catfish, which are...
In the farm-raised catfish, you said.
Catfish are a reasonable choice. They're quite inexpensive. Other choices you might consider include farmed shellfish, such as mollusks or oysters. Mussels.
Oh, mussels, yeah.
Or oysters. If you like
farm raised
crayfish, as a good choice, herring I think are a reasonable choice. Ecologically, mahi-mahi or dolphin fish is a good choice, although there is some evidence of at least some mercury contamination in mahi-mahi. But certainly to eat it occasionally, I don't think is problematic. Shrimp, it's hard to give advice on. A kind of shrimp that's really good ecologically. There are a lot of problems with shrimp farming, which is almost entirely in developing countries. And in many places, shrimp farms have been sited in mangrove forests and other wetlands and have come at a big ecological cost. On the other hand, shrimp fishing, most of it involves trawling along the bottom, which is just potentially destructive to the bottom of the ocean. And in addition, the shrimp fishery has the highest what's called bycatch or bykill rate of any fishery worldwide. Bycatch is the taking of fish besides the one you want to catch. And most bycatch comes on board fishing vessels dead and is dumped overboard. So it's essentially waste, killing critters that sort of needlessly. In the case of the shrimp fishery worldwide, the bycatch rate is about 5 to 1. In other words, about 5 pounds of marine life are killed for every pound of shrimp that's brought in. So for the most part, I don't feel like I can advise people that shrimp are ecologically a good choice. There is on the West Coast in northern waters and on the East Coast some small alternative shrimp fisheries, shrimp fishery in Maine, trap caught what are called spot prawns on the West Coast that don't have bycatch problems. But those shrimp are hard to get, particularly if you live outside those areas.
You said farm-raised Alaskan salmon has high dioxin. It's not good.
No.
Oh?
I really suggest listeners actually get go on the web or...
I don't have access to
it. So that they can have information in front of them. There is no salmon farming in Alaska. All the salmon that come from Alaska are wild. It's an extremely abundant fishery. I think people can, consumers can feel good about buying Alaskan salmon. There is some evidence that the feed that is used to produce farmed salmon, at least in Europe, is sometimes contaminated with dioxins. There's a lot going on to examine that issue, but between that and, to my mind, even more important, the ecological concerns about salmon farming, as a consumer, I always choose wild salmon from Alaska over farmed salmon. Mm. And virtually any salmon that you see in the store that says Atlantic salmon is going to be farmed. And that's because there are virtually no wild Atlantic salmon left, certainly not enough to support big commercial fisheries. And Atlantic salmon is the primary species used for farming salmon. So, you know, the cryptic way to think about it is wild salmon from Alaska are good, and virtually all the wild salmon we get in this country is from Alaska. Farmed Atlantic salmon are not so good to buy.
We're almost out of time. There's one point I wanted to raise real quick. There has been a lot of concern in the past few years in livestock about diseases called transmissible spongiform encephalopathies. BSE is one commonly called mad cow, and the concern was that the disease got into the cows because we were feeding them other animals. And so we said here in this country, I believe, is my understanding, we said we stopped that practice. We're in livestock production, we weren't going to feed one animal to another. Now here,
we don't feed ruminants.
Okay, so that's...
We still feed chickens, ground animals.
Right, okay, yes, indeed, right, because the thought is that it's not... There's nothing that the chickens could have that then the...
Right, chickens and pigs, actually. It's I think, right. Sheep and cows that
right.
can no longer be fed ground-up
right.
animals.
But on that same sort of issue here, if we're talking about some farm-raised fish being fed other fish, ground-up fish, and I also don't want to invent a problem that doesn't exist, but is there any concern that there might be some possibility of transmission of disease in that way?
Well, at the moment, I don't know of any compelling evidence that there is a problem. That said, the science of these transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, which are caused by little proteins called prions, is incredibly new, and scientists are just beginning to understand the issue. So whether we'll find a problem in the future, I have no idea.
Well, and before we go, also, you did mention the fact that your organization or other organizations have information that, like we've been discussing here on the web, there may be some people listening to us who don't have web access. Is there something that they can get, some printed material they can get by writing to you?
Sure. Listeners can get information from Environmental Defense by writing to us. Write to Environmental Defense at 1875 Connecticut Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009, and I'm sure you can get a copy of our list that's on the web. The National Audubon Society's Living Oceans Program in Islip, New York, Islip is ISLIP, also has information that can be mailed out. Unfortunately, I don't have that address with me.
Okay. Well, I'm sure that that's either something we can come up with, or people should be able to get that fairly easily, the Audubon Society. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. My apologies. We got some people we can't take, but that is it for the time that we have. And again, I want to thank you, Dr. Goldberg, for talking with us.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Our guest, Dr. Rebecca Goldberg. She's a biologist in the New York office of the Environmental Defense Fund. She's also director of EDF's biotechnology program.